It's time now for All You Ever Wanted to Know, a chance for you to get to know what's going on in and around your community and the fabulous people that make it happen. With On the Land, here's Jack Dawes.
Yes, indeed. So that's Lee Greenwood's famous version of God Bless Canada, and hope you had a great Canada Day as we did. Capped it off with fireworks across the lake at Saltcoats. It didn't rain as it was forecast to, although, of course, as you've been hearing, southern Manitoba got a big splash, and we'll tell you more about that on the program here today, the big deluge. USMCA, the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Trade Agreement, officially went into force yesterday, good, bad, or indifferent. We'll hear from Alana Cook, who is now with the Global Food Security Institute, who has quite a bit of track record with international trade from a number of career paths she has been along. And also today, we take a look at a new product on the market. We've talked about it here before. Recycling batteries to put manganese and other foliar applicants on the field. Well, the story of the week, as it happened, is in Brandon and north of Brandon to the Riding Mountain National Park area. Localized flooding and washouts on the Trans-Canada Highway east of Brandon was just the beginning. Now, Harry Siemens captured the story in this conversation with Rivers area farmer Ron Cron, just northwest of Brandon and just downstream on the Little Saskatchewan River from the town of Rapid City, where a portion of an earth-fill local dam gave way.
Rain started Sunday. We've had anywhere between 5 and 10 inches on our land. We have 3 weather stations set up on some of our properties, so it was able to measure quite accurately. We have another couple neighbors with stations as well. So, it came over about 15 hours, so it came quite quick. Our topography is quite rolling and you know, just with the little valleys and ravines, and that we have some places, you know, where we can have a 200-foot elevation change in 3 or 4 miles. So when the water starts going, water starts running, it runs quite quickly. So yeah, we have lots of roads washed out. We lost a bunch more roads. So it's getting interesting as to how to even move around and check fields. And then there's always, I guess, concern as to how quickly they'll be able to be fixed, because the storm kind of came right along the Little Saskatchewan River watershed, and so it seems like right from Brandon, it's not super wide, but I'm guessing that kind of the major storm was about 50 kilometers wide. It went right from kind of Brandon and then right up to Riding Mountain National Park, so... And that's all in our watershed. So there's a lot of water to come down through Minnedosa, then Rapid City, and then Rivers. So yeah, crops. It's a little hard to tell with crops because they're still all green. They haven't started turning yellow yet where the water's standing. So I don't know. My best guess is that we'll probably lose 10% of our crop. But I'm hopeful that the other 90% could be. We had an amazing looking crop before the storm came. So I don't know. I'm trying to be hopeful, at least to think that the other 90% will be could be very, very good, and we could still turn out okay. It's just hard to know at this point.
Absolutely. I've covered many floods over the years, and sometimes I remember even one year when I think it was 2004. My brother was, I think he was just barely, I think it was maybe the first or second year he had soybeans. He had 25 acres of soybeans totally underwater for almost 2 weeks. And it still yielded 25 bushels to an acre later.
Yeah.
You know, and so those are the kinds of stories. So you basically have summed up very good. So you said the crop was looking good. So what did you plant this year?
We have wheat and canola and peas, soybeans and sunflowers. So I think the soybeans will probably handle the excessive moisture the best. Where unfortunately where our peas were, that was in the area that had close to 10 inches. I think they will probably struggle sooner. And it depends on how quickly the water can get away. There's lots of water backed up behind roads, which is just kind of holding it back. But also sometimes that's protecting, another road downstream if it's held back a little bit. So I'm sure we've lost a few more roads.
So do you drive your pickup or four-wheeler? Where do you go?
I've been using a pickup right now, but it depends. Still trying to figure out, what water can be crossed safely, and obviously caution, being very cautious. So, but there's water running over highways in a few places in the area here as well. So, it's made things rather inconvenient for many people.
Did you say you had wheat?
Yeah, that's right. Wheat and canola. Soybeans. You were asking about bugs. We had a lot of flea beetle pressure. We had some cutworms in the sunflowers. I'm assuming that they've drowned after 5 to 10 inches. So I think hopefully bug issues are a thing of the past now for this year at least. But every year there's always something.
I've been driving to Winnipeg and back a few times. I'm seeing some wheat is pretty tall already. What was yours at?
Yeah, ours was kind of a flagging stage. The first field was just starting to hit, we're behind a little bit. Typically by July long weekend or by July 1st, most of our wheat would be just nicely starting to hit. So we're a little bit behind, but canola is definitely a little more behind than some years. We planted our canola a little later this year, just trying to beat the flea beetle pressure. But with the way the spring was being cool for so long, I'm not sure that strategy worked this year. But I
looked at your profile picture. You're water skiing, right?
Wakeboarding, I think. So.
Oh, wakeboarding. Said, boy, now you got a little bigger area.
Well, our local lake has gone up, I think, about 7-8 feet in the last 24 hours. Or from Sunday at 2 in the afternoon, we were down at the lake for the baptism, and the next, it was up 7-8 feet. So our local campground is, some of it's flooded, and there's a few houses and a private campground that are at risk. So, yeah, there's lots of nervous people. So.
Which lake is that?
It's commonly referred to as Rivers Lake, but the official name is Lake Wattapana. It's a nice lake for recreation, and it's a water supply for the town. But yeah, there was a bunch of the lake came up so quickly overnight that there were some boats that floated loose. The story is that at least two of them went over the spillway. So that was not good.
So that again, Harry Siemens in conversation with Ron Cron, now upstream from the town of Rivers at Rapid City. There was part of an earth berm of a dam went out that created the situation that they were talking about there, with where the water came up 6 to 8 feet all of a sudden. And then above that, the town of Minnedosa, as you heard, they you probably have heard they have a dam there as well, and they took some logs out apparently and saved that one. But other entities, such as there's, if you travel the Highway 10, but on the way to Brandon, just north of Brandon, there's an underpass there that we understand was washed out. The Highway 1 east of Winnipeg was washed out. Town of Rivers, between there and Brandon, there was a washout on another provincial road. So I understand people from that area, to get into Brandon, they go about 20 miles west of Rivers and then come back up to the Trans-Canada Highway west of Brandon. So quite a situation. Now, it turns out that evacuations were necessary in Minnedosa, and some local railway tracks also were undermined. Now, Harry learned more about the weather that was in the conversation upcoming with Scott Keeler of Weather Logic. But Harry's with us now. Harry, just set it up for us. What is Weather Logic? And then we'll play that audio.
Weather Logic is a new company started by Scott Taylor and one other person, and they they have subscriptions from farmers where they give them daily forecasts and keep, and so they're basically weather consulting forecasting company that looks after farmers who subscribe to their services. And so he follows me on Twitter, and I may have heard him or watched him or read some of his tweets. And so I gave him a call this morning just to give me a perspective on what a weather guy, scientist or researcher, talks about and sees when some of these things happen. He made a pretty good description as to how this weather format or weather system set up.
Scott, first of all, size it up for me.
Well, the month of June was a month of wild weather. We had earlier in the month flooding in southeastern Manitoba, and then later in the month flooding in western Manitoba with a bunch of thunderstorms that went through. And it was all kind of caused by a pattern in the jet stream where we had a large area of low pressure on the west coast. And that caused the jet stream to kind of come up from the southwest across the eastern prairies. And with that, it was carrying a lot of moisture out of the central U.S. And all of that moisture, heat, and humidity helped to create a bunch of days where we had severe thunderstorms rolling through. And the worst of those were, at least recently, in western Manitoba, where we had a line of storms that kept passing over the same spot and gave Brandon over 6 inches of rain in a matter of a few hours.
So, and then, of course, we had that rain. I mean, I talked to Ron Cron, who farms at Rivers, and he gave me a real good snapshot of what had happened the first go-around on last Sunday. I mean, he talked then about with three different weather stations from 5 to 10 inches. And so now, when I spoke to him just, you know, after the Wednesday or Tuesday night, he's saying it went from 6 to 12 inches. And so, we've seen that. And how big, I mean, right now it looks like entire Manitoba is got enough moisture for now. Is that how you see it?
Well, I would say that some areas now have too much, and there's still some spots that have too little. I've heard from some farmers in the Interlake that really missed out on a lot of this rain and are still looking for more, but it seems that most people right now are fairly good for moisture. In south-central areas, I think people are fairly happy. They got some moisture with these storms, but not too much, so they're in fairly good shape. But the western Manitoba farmers were looking for moisture, and then all of a sudden they got way too much. So it's for some people too much and others still too little, but luckily there are some folks in between that are kind of just about right with some of these recent storms.
So then the other thing Ron Cron told me, he said, you know, with all that rain, you know, he was still hoping that he may not have lost more than 10% of his acres. And so that's pretty amazing, I guess, when you look at all the things and the farmers you work with. In the southeastern Manitoba, I think there the water stays longer and they lose more, but over there it moves quicker from what I gather.
Yeah, it could be. In western Manitoba, they have a bit more terrain, so we may get a bit more runoff there and help to keep fields drier after these rain events. But I think what I've been hearing is that there's some river flooding concerns now, so that won't affect as many farmers because it's more localized along the river itself. But there are some people, especially around rivers, that are under threat from possible flooding of some rivers there that are now well over their capacity.
Tell me again, in a nutshell, what it is that you do for farmers and the service you provide.
Well, WeatherLogix, what we do is provide farmers with a daily weather forecast for their farm. And with that information, they see everything from temperature trends to humidity to wind, and that really helps them to plan their days. A lot of farmers recently have been asking about when it's not going to be so windy so that they can do some spraying. We had a fairly windy June, one of the windiest on record, so that really hampered spraying efforts. And so they watch our forecast to see when the wind might be a bit lower so they can spray. And similar use, they'll use things like rain forecast for possibly applying fertilizers or other applications to the field. So all that information is something they watch on a day-to-day basis, and then it really helps them to target their decisions based on when the weather is ideal.
So that again, Harry Siemens in conversation with Scott Keeler of WeatherLogic. Now here in Saskatchewan, the official crop report is not out yet. It's usually in by about this time. But of course, there has been some rains through a good part of the province here in the Yorkton area. I think we caught up fairly well, but of course you can always use more. I live at Saltcoats. Over the weekend past, we had a couple of decent rains, I believe, and the crop conditions will be moving ahead from there. So Harry Siemens, in the interview with Ron Cron, he mentioned he thought he had lost about 10% of his crop. Now, you did that interview for us a couple of days ago. What's your latest and best assessment of how that big weather system may impact crops in that, I'm going to call it south central Manitoba?
You know, it's really interesting. I mean, I talked also, and I think you and I were just talking, and we didn't, you know, I talked a bit to Scott Taylor about that, you know, and what he was seeing from farmers. And, you know, like in the southeast, of course, we talked about that, where they had the weather system, and it's still kind of ongoing. There's no drainage, you know, it all has to kind of come, I think, east or west from there and get to the Red River, but there isn't the biggest slope as there is going the other way. And so they, of course, have more standing water longer. And that, of course, is much worse, whereas Ron Cron and what he was basing on, they had such high, you know, sure, they would have some really washed-out roads badly, because when you have 200-foot difference in topography, then, you know, it can run pretty quickly. Hilly, of course, is what he's talking about. And so that can, you know, he figures, yeah, the low spots and some of the washout areas, they would see more damage. But he said the crop itself, of course, is so good that from a standpoint right now, when I listen to watch and read the guys on Twitter, that, you know what, it's the areas where they don't have the drainage, and it just didn't dry. Like some of these areas started wet with a top, the subsoil moisture right at the top, and so those guys are in a bit more trouble. But you know what? I didn't talk to an agronomist, but you know, it's a testament again, Jack, to the breeding that we do, the varieties that we have, and the absolute wonderful techniques of putting in that crop, looking after it by the farmers, that actually I believe in cases like this, you know, stands in good stead and they don't lose as much. But he was being optimistic at 10%. I haven't seen that optimism change on Twitter following him.
All right. So now, Harry, we've been making you do double duty this week, and you've got an update on some of the pulse crops for us with a guy we'll call Mr. Bean. Tell us about Mr. Bean and what's up next.
Dennis Lang, you know, I think I've known him probably as long as I've known you, Jack. And
well, that's a long time.
And, you know, he's just one of those down-to-earth agronomists and farmer, you know, he helps farmers all the time. He worked for Perron Seeds in the, you know, St. Joseph for many years, and that got bought by Elkintyre, I think it was. He bought that company. So from there, he went with Manitoba Agriculture. But he farms. He also farms 5 miles east of Emerson, which is on the other side of the Red River. And he, too, talked about his crops, and he said we had a couple of 2.5-inch rains, but they were far enough apart that a little bit of drowned out, but for the most part, the rest of it looks good. I always remember my father, who farmed 1,000 acres in 1960, he always said, you know, he'd rather have the low spots drown out than the high spots look dry, because then he knew he still had a pretty decent crop. And I think Dennis Lang is his name. He's, we call him Mr. Bean because that's his handle on Twitter. So Dennis, Mr. Bean Lang, talks about the pulse crops, which he is in charge of as far as agronomy is concerned with Manitoba Ag.
My guest here is Dennis Lang with the with Manitoba Agriculture. And Dennis, tell me, you know, we've had a real weird kind of year starting way back when, last fall, I guess.
Yes.
And so now we've had a bunch of rain events. So let's look first of all at the pulses. Where are we at with them, do you think?
Well, let's kind of start with steel peas, I guess. There was a bit more interest again in steel peas with growing peas again for this year. We had about 110,000 acres last year, and we're probably going to be somewhere around 150,000 acres this year. In this area, the growers that are growing peas, they look pretty good. They've missed a lot of the big rains that some areas have gotten. Some of the peas out west, remain to be seen yet, because there's some pretty major rains out in the west, so I think some of those fields, there might be some losses there. With respect to dry beans, the dry bean growing area kind of stretches from the Altona, Winkler area up through Carmen and Portage, and there's some in the southwest as well. Source Boise Rain area, through the main growing region, I guess, down in the valley here, Red River Valley here. Those areas, those fields look pretty good yet. Moisture-wise, you might lose some low spots and that type of thing, but overall rainfall amounts weren't that significant in those regions where dry beans are growing, whereas, you know, areas around Souris, they've had more rain there, so there's definitely going to be more losses out that way.
So then we go from there, we go to soybeans. What kind of soybean acres do you think we finally got in?
Well, I guess we'll know more in a couple of weeks here. Growers had until Tuesday to complete their seeded acre report. So, but my best guess right now, based on what growers I've talked to in the industry, somewhere around 1 million acres. So maybe a little bit less than last year. There's been a few things that kind of went into that decision-making process for growers. The last 2 to 3 years, we've had some pretty dry years and dry summers, and those have reduced the yields for a lot of growers. And we haven't got those rains in July and August that we're so accustomed to getting used to. And with respect to pricing too, that pricing has been a little bit lower. So growers, in some instances, kind of moved things around a little bit, maybe grew a few more kennel acres or moved into some peas or some flowers or a few other crops, just moved things around a little bit. So, but you know what, the soybean crop looks decent. There were growers rolling here about a week and a half ago around their post-emergent rolling. So that's pretty much all done now because we're past the stage now where rolling is going to be done. And weed control for the most part has been good. Growers have been able to get in even with the strong winds. We've been able to find small windows where you can go and get some spraying done when it gets a little quieter. So I think overall, no real big challenges so far, but, you know, we're just getting into July now, so we'll see how things progress for the month of July.
So we've heard a lot about bugs and pests on a lot of the other crops in different parts. Are the pulses susceptible to them as much as the others?
They can be. Grasshoppers can, eat any crop if it's green, if there's no other alternative food sources. Like dry beans wouldn't be their preferred crop, for example. But, you know, if the food supply for the grasshoppers is limited, they will go into some of the pulses. We don't have all the same issues. Cutworms this year, not as pronounced as it was last year. There was a lot more spraying for cutworms last year. The next big thing for peas in this area would be pea aphids, and that's usually kind of around flowering. So we encourage growers to scout for pea aphids and do some sweeps to determine if they're at threshold levels yet. And as far as the, you know, the soybeans and the dry beans, not really a lot of pressure other than grasshoppers. So, and, right now, I haven't had any calls really on, on growers questioning whether they should be spraying their soybeans at all. So I think if there's alternative food sources, the grasshoppers prefer that. So.
I think you were concerned that soybean acres might drop even more than what you're now suggesting around that 1 million acres.
That's still up in the air yet. It's kind of been bouncing around a little bit. Sometimes there's some late fields that go in. So somewhere in the million acre mark. Might be a little less than that. But, I think that's a realistic number at this point. So,
plant protein.
So that again, conversation with Harry Siemens and Mr. Bean about some of the pulse crop progress in Manitoba. Harry, I was caught off the top by his discussion of the acres, and I'm wondering if I heard him right. Did he say he's expecting pea acreage to jump from 110,000 to 150,000?
That's what he said. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. He was quite confident about that.
Yeah. So would you tie that directly to the fact that, all right, there's this Merit company in Winnipeg, and then we've been talking about Roquette at Portage la Prairie. Is that, I guess maybe it's somewhat obvious, but that's obviously, let's say, motivating some farmers to grow more pea acreage. Am I close on that?
Yes, well, see, we stopped the interview where I asked him about the plant protein and exactly how all of that would fit in, and then he talked about not only the pea acres going from 1 to 150, but the fava beans also went up because the Roquettes have a special division that they're setting up so that they can use fava beans as well. So yeah, all of that, of course, is. And of course, soybeans he made that very clear. Soybeans, not obviously used for human consumption and any of these plants. And so, in fact, they're very strict about not having any soybeans in any of those samples. And so they, of course, are different. But no, the pea acres, and, it'll be interesting. They don't like the wetness as much. As soon as it gets a little wet, peas just suffer greatly. So, as you said, the jury is still out on how those peas up in western Manitoba, because that's where the bulk of the increase in acres we have. I think some areas in the Interlake where they also have been planting some peas in a section there. And, so we'll have to wait and see on that one. And, it's interesting about what he said
So Harry, I think what we'll do here, we need to take a commercial break, which we will do, and then we'll come back and we'll recue that interview with Dennis Lang and get his comments about the acreage. You're listening to On the Land from The Rock.
You're listening to All You Ever Wanted to Know. If you have a question for today's guest, call 783-5160 or 1-855-449-5160.
So just to pick up our conversation, Harry Siemens was in discussion with Mr. Bean, Dennis Lang, about pulse crops and acreage and the impact that a couple of processing plants are having. So we'll just pick that up again with Mr. Lang. Mr. Bean.
Well, fava beans would be one. There was a recent announcement here that Roquette is partnering with Prairie Fava to work with fava beans. So that's definitely going to be a bonus for the fava bean growers. That's always been a bit of a challenge with fava beans in Manitoba is not having the marketability of the product widespread. We've always been, looking at exporting our fava beans overseas, and sometimes those markets are smaller. Now with this protein market coming in with the favas, that will definitely be beneficial for fava bean producers. Peas are the big one there. When it comes to the protein side of things, because it's human food and soybeans, soybeans typically are the peas and the fava beans. So.
Anything to add to anything that sticks out in your mind that I didn't cover?
I think the biggest thing to kind of look at this year is, scouting is a good thing to do in your pulse crops through the season. Once you spray that second pass sometimes on soybeans, you kind of leave it and not go back there. But I think it's so important to kind of keep an eye on what weeds are still popping through. If in soybeans, for example, if you notice any few weird patches of weeds pop up, you might want to have a closer examination of those areas to see what's going on, what kind of weed pressure you have. So to see if whether or not there's any resistance issues. The scouting goes ahead for peas as well. Scouting for soybean or for PA at this stage as well is something you're going to be looking at doing here to make sure you don't miss any windows there. And then for dry beans, we're getting into fungicide season here. So over the next few weeks here, we're going to have growers assessing whether or not there's a need for fungicide on their crops and nuts, and using all the factors that go into it as far as judging whether or not the variety is susceptible, whether or not there's enough canopy there, and whether the development is good, or if there's good condition for disease development. So those things, I think, scouting moving forward is probably the best thing I can give growers for advice on.
So that's, again, a conversation between a pulse crop specialist, Dennis Lang, now with Manitoba Agriculture, and Harry Siemens. Well, just on that note, we, of course, have been following some of these developments in the protein industry, along with peas and fava beans. The Canadian Prairie Pea and Fava Bean Protein Processing and Research was launched recently with a $19 million Protein Industries Canada project. Protein Industries Canada, part of the federal so-called supercluster concept, funded with multi-millions of federal dollars in 2018.
So the research is really looking at how we improve the efficiency of processing pea and fava at Roquette Plant.
So what will these products go for? What will they be used for?
Yeah, the main focus of the products that will be produced through this R&D is really human food uses, and that's an exciting market category because it's some of the highest value products that these protein isolates and protein concentrates can go into. So largely human food consumption.
That's Bill Gruel. He's with Protein Industries Canada. Gruel, formerly an oilseed specialist with the Sask Ag Ministry.
It could be any number of end-use markets. So the protein that will be produced out of this plant could go into any number of markets. It could be meat substitutes. It could be beverages. It could be supplementing other products with higher protein content and concentrations. So any number of end-use markets for human food.
And the idea is really to come up with a new processing. Do I understand that correctly? It's really to meet some challenges for pea and fava on the prairies.
So Bill Gruel says the unique prairie climate is a vital component of pulse crop production here.
So most Canadian conditions are unique pea and fava products that are coming in on the front end. They have to deal with cold conditions. This is the first plant that will be operating in a Canadian winter, so we've got some work to do there. So beyond optimization, though, it's about developing new products and novel products based on the Canadian feedstock of peas and fava beans. And so just not only optimization, but the development of new products as well.
Now, on the question of protein and development of the industry, the Global Institute for Food Security in Saskatoon is part of this equation. And we had a chance to discuss some of that with Lana Cook. She's a former deputy ag minister and deputy to the premier. And she's the chair of the board of directors at what is known as the Global Food Safety Institute, officially Global Institute for Food Security. I talked with Lana Cook this morning as a follow-up to the implementation of the Canada-US-Mexico free trade deal, the global food industry making and the science.
So the Global Institute for Food Security was set up in 2012 by the government of Saskatchewan, the University of Saskatchewan, and at that time Potash Corp, which is now, of course, Nutrien. And it was founded to be able to perform research that would help deliver transformative innovation to agriculture in both the developed world, so benefiting us here in Saskatchewan and in Canada, and as well as other developed nations, but definitely also in the developing world. You know, we often hear this discussion about, you know, by 2050, we're going to have to improve agriculture productivity by about 70% to be able to meet the world's food needs. So GIFT is going to have a really important role in bringing ingenuity and innovation to the table, provide these improvements, create technologies that will help provide commercial advancement in both, as I said, Saskatchewan, as well as taking that discovery and that innovation and that commercial, you know, product, whatever it might be, into the developing world as well. So do more to sort of produce here to be able to help feed the world, but also help others feed themselves. So it's sort of a dual mandate that GIFT was set up to do.
I wonder if I could ask you for maybe a couple of examples of projects or something that interests you as far as your involvement with the Food Security Institute that would help us understand how it works.
Sure. Well, we've got four program areas, and so maybe I'll mention those program areas, and then I'll get into, you know, some specifics. So we deal in digital and computational agriculture. We work on root and soil microbial interactions. We work on seed and development biology, and then we also have what's called our omics and precision agriculture laboratory. So maybe I'll talk about that fourth program area and just, you know, tell you a little bit about that. So the Omics and Precision Agriculture Laboratory, or OPAL, is really a state-of-the-art lab that we've got at GIFT that provides, you know, these are words that, you know, scientists and agriculture scientists throw around, you know, like it's regular language, but this lab provides genomics, and bioinformatics services to Western Canadian producers, as well as public and private research organizations. And so it's a collaboration of the U of S, the NRC, Agriculture and Agri-Food Canada, but it's led by GIFT, and it's the first lab in Canada to provide integrated crop data and precision ag technologies to support a wide range of research and commercial stakeholders. So, you know, it's world-class, it's at scale, it, you know, can really advance crop breeding. I mean, we do things at an accelerated rate in addition to, you know, reduced waste and increased efficiency for agronomists, breeders, producers, and all these clients that will be coming to OPAL. So that's an example of a pretty unique capacity that we've got here in Saskatchewan as a result of GIFT that GIFT operates. So that's, you know, that's a really great example. I guess another example would be work that is going on in quite a few crops in roots. And so having a look at the roots, we've often had a lot of the breeding and the work being done in agriculture in the crop above the ground. But the work that's being done at GIFT is really looking at the roots below the ground and looking to see, do we have proper nutrient uptake? What kind of structure allows roots to be able to make the most of the moisture that's in the ground? And so this work is being done on canola as well as some other crops. And so, you know, this will be game-changing in our ability to get more crop per drop, you know, seeing better productivity because of stronger roots and roots that can take more of the nutrients and more of the moisture out of the soil. So there's a couple of sort of examples that will tell you about the work that we do at GIFT.
That, again, a conversation with Alana Cook, who's the chair for GIFTS. Well, an assessment by Reuters news agency suggests that the just-implemented Canada-U.S.-Mexico trade agreement, CUSMA, could open a Pandora's box of new trade irritants for North America. Reuters analysts suggest manipulation and new rules on digital commerce that didn't exist when NAFTA was launched in 1994 will be complicated. Now, Donald Trump, of course, famously called NAFTA the worst trade deal ever made and threatened to end it. What he'll do with CUSMA, we don't know. CUSMA launches as the coronavirus has our countries in a recession, of course. Trade flows normally in the $1.2 trillion U.S. annually. It's down to its lowest monthly level in a decade. And another critic, a lady from the Syracuse University Economics Department, Mary Lovelace, says this could be a trade agreement that quickly ends up in dispute and higher trade barriers. Well, on the other hand, an equally astute and experienced observer thinks our focus could well be on the fact that we are a trading nation first and foremost, and that would be Alana Cook, whom you just heard from, the board chair with GIFS. Now, Alana and her husband, Jerry Hertz, are farmers at Edenwold. She's a former Saskatchewan deputy ag minister. Previously, as well, she was the exec with the Western Canadian Wheat Growers.
Hertz USMCA is apparently now officially engaged. What would your observations be on what its impact will have on Canadian agriculture? Could we begin with that, please?
Yeah, well, you know, the agreement is vital to hundreds of thousands of farmers, ranchers, food manufacturers, exporters who rely on trade for our livelihood. The reality is Canada is a trading nation. Agriculture and food is a huge part of our trade. If you think about Saskatchewan, we're the most trade-dependent province in the country, the largest or second largest exporter of agriculture and food. So for Saskatchewan, this is a huge deal. And in light of the rising protectionism in the U.S. and also around the world, you know, any agreement that will open trade and be rules-based and will lower trade barriers is positive. So I think this agreement is vital, and it's really important that it's come into effect, and need to look forward to ensuring that, you know, the three nations follow the rules that are set out in the agreement.
So it does seem, though, like there are a lot of, let's say, question marks, and there always seems to be trade disputes and issues with trade barriers. Do you feel that this will be an ongoing controversy?
Well, there's no question there's been uncertainty in the North American market since, you know, President Trump started talking about NAFTA being needing to be either reopened or eliminated. So USMCA will allow, you know, less uncertainty in the North American market, and, you know, will ensure that there are reduced tariffs or no tariffs on certain products, and will certainly enhance market access. But no question, there is still lots of protectionism in the U.S. And we're going to always have the challenge of holding the U.S. to account on this agreement. It's always been a challenge in trade agreements to make sure that countries follow by the rules. NAFTA was an example of that, where we often would have challenges with the U.S., but at least you had that agreement to hold them to account to. It's the same deal with USMCA. We've got a set-out agreement. We've got that to try to hold them to account. No question there's going to continue to be some challenges, but we do have that as a foundational piece to be able to rely on.
That, again, a conversation with Alana Cook and her agriculture insights, including the Global Institute for Food Security. The issue of sustainability in agriculture has been talked about for some time, and some new developments in that area we're going to get there. But before we do, just check back in with our friend and colleague, Harry Siemens. Harry, you wanted to update something, I think, from our discussion about pulse crops?
Not so much pulse crops, but the sunflower spraying. I talked last week about a chemical called Assert, and that it had been taken off the market. I erroneously mentioned that it had to do with weed resistance, but I checked again with Tammy Jones, who's the weed specialist with Manitoba Agriculture, and the more I see of her work, the more credibility in my eyes she has, and also the farmers. And so I said, she said, no, New Farm produced some Assert this year, but from what I understand, meaning Tammy, it's sourcing the technical ingredients that is difficult. I think the company is working to address limited supplies, but it's been an unexpected challenge. It's not taken off the market. It's simply a supply issue. And I just wanted to, because there were guys that were telling me on Twitter that they couldn't grow sunflowers, and especially the confectionery sunflowers, unless they had a cert. And so they were back to cultivating using iron, as we talked about last week, instead of chemical.
Right. Okay, well, great. Thanks for that, Harry. Well, that sort of ties into this next segment, because farmers, as we know, have been hearing the term sustainability for quite a while, like maybe 50 years. But so far, it had to be known if going green or farming sustainably is going to pay appropriate returns. The issue was one of the first questions asked on a webinar hosted Tuesday by Eberhardt Ag Solutions Group out of Langenberg. Dan Eberhardt led a webinar from his Brandon office where he spoke with the principals of ZM Grow, a European entity, specifically Finland. Their foliar applied fertilizer product is drawn from recycled batteries which we know are sold by the billions each year and which mostly we discard. The batteries up to now ended up in landfills or the garbage dump, if you like. Eberhardt Ag has just received its first bulk shipment of ZM Grow from Trace Grow, a company with connections both to Finland and the UK. Now, David Herod is a Brit described as being from a family which has been in the essential nutrient supply business for several hundred years, and he's tied in with ZM Grow, talking about sustainability and when farmers might benefit. He sees it coming first in Ireland. This clip also includes Dan Eberhardt's response.
They are coming first in Europe and maybe Finland, Baltic states maybe, Timo?
Yeah.
But there has to be a measure of incentives, either carrots, which is financial, give you some money, the farmer, or the stick, which is you're going to get taxed. There are two things. I don't know what they are. I think it'll be a balance. I think money on the table, 18 to 24 months, something in the EU, in Europe, will become a law.
I've seen legislation being tabled in the United States of America in this regard. So it is a conversation and things are being measured, and as data becomes more available and we can quantify these things, you bet your bottom dollar this is coming for everybody in the industry.
So that, again, an exchange there with David Herod and Dan Eberhardt, part of a webinar this week. Eberhardt Ag Solutions is also the originator for Biosol, a bulk fertilizer compiled from human food waste and sulfur. In this case, sulfur, which otherwise would be burned off as a petroleum industry byproduct. In their product launch, Eberhardt Ag is offering farmers 2 acres of product free in exchange for their infield data while using ZM Grow. ZM, by the way, is the zinc and manganese extraction from the batteries we talked about, that extraction used in this foliar application. Now, agronomist Terry Eberhardt found the ZM Grow product during a visit to the big Agritechnica farm show in Germany.
ZM Grow booth, and immediately thought, hey, this is really something unique. So when it comes to zinc and manganese or regrowth and maturity and all kinds of other things, we know, as it's commented in the chat, it can be a bit of a crop safener, so especially in pulses. A lot of times agronomists would recommend some kind of a foliar with zinc in it to help help the pulse crops metabolize the herbicide and not get that yellow flash as much. So we've been working on a granular zinc program for quite a few years, but even with that, you know, our tissues are kind of marginal, still a bit marginal on zinc. And then manganese also can be very important and something that we're low in at times. And so I always look at, I mean, we're not always looking for just a recipe that fits for everybody, but when you do need multiple nutrients, it's there's some synergies there when it can go on at the same time. And even just from the convenience factor for the farmer and the grower, or your guy mixing in a sprayer, if you need both zinc and manganese and there's a benefit there, it's nice to have it in one jug versus two separate jugs that you gotta mix separately, right? And I'm actually quite intrigued and excited about the potential of having copper in there too, because that's something generally in our area here that we work with our clients. Copper is something that we're a bit low on and in need of as well. So that, I think that could be a really, really interesting combination. So, yeah, that's kind of where I think there could be a lot of value here, and it'll be really interesting to see how this product fares in our market. And, yeah, so we've seen kind of in our tissues and stuff over the years that basically the micronutrients that we need to worry about here in our geography is zinc and boron and copper and manganese are kind of the ones that show up as being low in the crop. So
that again, Terry Eberhardt, part of a webinar earlier this week. And by the way, farmers will be saying, Jack, show me the money. What's the cost? The ZM Grow product, my understanding is going to come in at $7.50 an acre. And again, Eberhardt Ag is offering up a couple of jugs gratis to farmers who want to give it a try in return for the data that they might produce when they try the product. Well, one of the questions that dogs our world of COVID-19 is what happens next. The next includes now or what we pay back for the myriad of support programs rolled out by governments in Canada, the U.S., and elsewhere. A previous program, we touched on this issue with a farmer businessman type, Dwayne Kruger of Saltcoats, who also has a background in economics. We pick up the conversation on that matter of value in North America. In North America, the gold standard disappeared maybe 50 years ago in the Nixon years of the U.S. presidency.
I believe it was in 1971. He essentially, with the stroke of a pen, just got rid of the Bretton Woods system that existed before it for around 40 years, I believe. And that was sort of the last tie, even though it was already quite vague, between the currency and its association with something of value. If you go back into the First World War, Second World War time, there was a more direct tie of a currency with gold. It could be actually convertible, right?
So just to question you there. So the Bretton Woods system, I think you called it, was our gold-backed system backed the dollar with gold?
It was at that point already vague and you know, not as specific, but it had to be tied to something, which limited the amount a central bank could use the current things we do today, which are, as you're seeing in the last couple weeks, the amount of what I call quantitative easing, just creating liquidity out of nowhere by expanding balance sheets, that wouldn't have been possible under a gold-backed type system. And again, we are doing that in a major way. Really, if you look at what I've been talking about in these last 20 years, every time there's been a financial crisis, in 01, in 08, to a lesser extent in 15, and the one we're currently dealing with, the central banks and the governments of the world have used three stimulus-type policies. The one is government deficit financing. The second one is artificially lowering interest rates, which we've done, and we see extremely low interest rates in the current time. And the third one is this monetary policy by the central banks called quantitative easing. And it's essentially increasing their balance sheet. What it would be like for the average person to understand is, say your net worth is $10. but you go and you buy, you go to the bank and get a loan. And now your net worth doesn't change. It's still $10, but you have access to another $1,000, which is a liability. And because that $1,000 now existed and didn't exist before, it's also an asset. But it doesn't affect your net worth. It just increases. And so, in effect, what you're doing there is increasing the debt load, but it's covered on both sides.
So that, again, conversation with Dwayne Krueger, Dwayne has some very deep insights into how all this fits with Scripture, and you can find more background some of Dwayne's talks and sermons on this on the Alliance Church website, and also here on The Rock Sunday evenings at 6:30, a program, it's a podcast called For Such a Time, hosted by Scott Fitzsimmons of The Rock, and with more insights from Mr. Krueger on the world of finances and its basis in Scripture. Well, thanks for joining us on the program, and thanks to our good friend Harry Siemens, contributed a whole bunch today, as he always does, and the guy that knits it all together for me sits across from me, Jordan Potswald, our producer. I'm Jack Dawes on the land from The Rock.